So I'm here to talk to you about a recent result. It's only about a month old. And we're pretty excited about, essentially, we have a lot of the same motivations that Hans has for considering scale invariants. But it's a local scale invariants that he talked about. But it's only the three-dimensional metric, not the full 40 thing that Lyle was talking about. And what we found is that actually general relativity is dual to a theory that has this particular scale invariance in it. But it's only dual up to global rescalings, which is why some of the things that Hans was talking about, these global things, are still important. So there's places where our work is definitely parallel to what Hans just talked about. And there's some issues with areas where it might have tangential vectors as well. So I'm kind of interested to talk more to him about it. So let me just start by motivating this idea of local scale invariants. So I can do, so the whole idea is motivated by this basic observation that all measurements are essentially local measurements of configuration. So what I can do is I can do a very simple, crude measurement. If I want to measure the length of this microphone, what I can do is I can take this laser pointer and like go like this and say one, two, just about two. So this microphone is about two times the length of this, right? And so that's a very crude measurement of the length of the microphone. But if you think about it very deeply, even more sophisticated measurements that we can make are essentially just comparisons like that. And I think that so the first slide that Tamara showed us is kind of a good example, especially in cosmology. This is important to have standard rulers and standard clocks and standard candles. And what these things are, I mean, the clocks are basically just, hands that point to, numbers, right? And so even measurements of time are essentially comparisons of configurations of things. And if you don't believe me, I'm not the only person to say this. So Weil said it in 1917, the year after Einstein published the theory of general relativity. And also, other smart people have said it, like Hans, just now. And John Bell. I realize it's probably really dangerous. I'm not really, to quote John Bell in front of people who probably have read him much more carefully than I have. But he did say this, in physics, the only observations we must consider are position observations, which is what I just said. If only the positions of instruments and pointers. And then he goes on to say that if you make axioms rather than definitions and theorems with a measurement of anything else, then you can have redundancy and risk inconsistency. So what he's saying is actually that you should, if you try to generalize this idea of measurement too much, you can run into problems. Okay. But really, what's sufficient is that the sort of first statement that he makes, which is that physics position observations. And it's, at the very basic level, you could just be looking at pointer positions on a dial, right? So that's the motivation. But as sort of, so what it motivates is to look for a symmetry of this form, where A and B are just going from 1 to 3. So this thing is the spatial metric, and it's multiplied by a conformal factor, and there's a factor of 4 here, which is just conventional. But you see there's an x dependence on the conformal factor, which means that it's just saying that, well, okay, if I have my microphone and my laser pointer here and I do this, and then I do the same measurement over here, but everything over here is 4 times bigger, then it doesn't change the ratio of the lengths of these two things. So because all measurements are done in their local neighborhood, we expect to have a local symmetry of this form. And so that's the statement that local scales are observable. Now the reason why this is the 3 metric is because really the heuristics, all of the arguments are basically based on spatial configurations. And when you try to talk about the 4 metric, then you run into the problems that Hans pointed out, which are that now you're comparing ratios of proper time. The proper time is something you can read on a clock. So it's really important that we're looking for a symmetry of the spatial metric and not the 4-dimensional thing. Okay. So the theory that we're going to have is dual theory, which is sort of equivalent to general relativity, is not Lorentz invariant. That's one thing that we're going to lose. So the image is not an image of a Lorentz invariant space-time, but it's something very different. And I think that that can have some interesting ramifications for quantum theory in particular. Okay, so this is the motivation. We're looking for a symmetry like this. Now, if you just apply the symmetry transformation to the Einstein-Hilbert action, you'll find that the Einstein-Hilbert action is not invariant under this particular symmetry. So we have to we have to do some work to figure out. Basically, we expect to see a symmetry like this based on these arguments that I just gave, but we don't actually see it arise in our theory. So that's a problem. All right. Okay. So before I get started, I realize I should probably give you guys a crash course on the 3+1 formulation of general relativity. Because that's going to be the backbone of everything I'm going to do for the rest of the talk. Basically, all you need to do, in order to do canonical quantum gravity, or you want to write down a Hamiltonian, you need to be able to split the metric into spatial parts and time parts, because you need to define momentum. Okay. So a convenient way to do that splitting is to take the four-dimensional metric and split it into these pieces here. So you've got the three metric here, and then the zero-zero component is this combination of these two ends. This guy with no vector index is called the lapse, and this guy with the vector index is called the shift. And they have various interpretations that I don't really have time to go into. But when you think of these guys, think of the zero-zero component essentially being here, and the zero I or zero A component is the somehow the shift vector of the metric. So then what you can do is you can take the Einstein-Hilbert action, apply the Jean-Marc transform to it, and essentially go from variables where you have G and G dot to G and pi. The pi is the momentum conjugate to it. But the problem is that there is a mismatch, that there's not a one-to-one mapping between these variables and these variables. So when you do the Legendre transform, what you find is there's some redundancy, and you get constraints. And it turns out that the Hamiltonian of general relativity is entirely proportional to just a constraint, or just two constraints. So this is the answer that you get when you're careful about how you do the Legendre transform. And there's a boundary term that you have to throw away, or I'm not going to talk about that. What you get is you get two constraints. One of them is, I'll talk about first, is this vector constraint, HA. And we call it the diffeomorphism constraint. So the diffeomorphism is just a fancy mathematical word for a change of coordinates, coordinate transformation. Constraints sort of generate symmetries. This particular constraint is telling you that the theory has a symmetry, which is that it's invariant under three-dimensional coordinate transformations. Okay? And it takes this form. So this constraint is relatively easy to deal with. We have a pretty good handle on it, and we have for a long time, quantum mechanically. The one that gives us a lot of trouble is this guy, the scalar constraint, S. Has this nasty sort of quadratic form. It's quadratic in terms of the momentum. This G, A, B, C, D is just some combination of the metric. And it's just a natural metric on the space of metrics. Okay. But the details of this equation are not really that important, just that it's really ugly. And this is the scalar curvature, and it has derivatives of the metric, and it has ugliness in it, okay? So this particular constraint is really hard to deal with. As I said, the presence of constraints tells you that you have symmetry. So what are the symmetries that this thing is generating? It's generating refoliations and reparameterizations. So you can imagine, this is the picture, okay, in 3+1 graph, because you have spatial slices, and the spatial slices are evolving in time. So you can imagine a space-time is just a stack of a bunch of spatial slices. And one thing that you can do is you can take those spatial slices and you can change their shape. So you can choose to slice the thing, the space-time, this way instead of this way. And that's a refoliation, okay? So this particular constraint is meant to be generating infinitesimal refoliations. But another thing that you can do is you can sort of also just rescale the global time. So you can kind of, you have the freedom to move more quickly or more slowly up and down the time direction. So these two things are kind of somewhat quantitatively different. Okay, so that's the sort of crash course on GR. What we've done is we found a way to trade these refoliations. So what I did is I sort of symbolically split this into two pieces. One that generates refoliations and one that generates reprimandizations. We can trade these guys for what we call volume-preserving conformal open strings transformations. So these are called conformal transformations. And what we're looking for is those ones that preserve the volume of the universe. So it's a trade. So you can kind of, if you think of this thing as being, it's a function of x. If you think of it as being an infinity constraints, then there's one that generates reparameterizations. We're trading infinity, these guys are infinity minus one. And so the thing we're trading them for also has to be infinity minus one. And so we're looking for all the conformal constraints, and the one is just that global mode that preserves the scale. Okay. So that's the idea. That's what we've been able to do. And so I'm just going to sort of sketch out the picture, and then I'll show you how we got to the picture. Okay. So this expression here, pi is just the sort of a trace, this combination of the metric and the length. And the mean is just the integral of this thing over the volume. So this thing on its own, basically is telling me that there is conformal symmetry. And this piece here is the global scale. Okay. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to trade that scalar constraint for constraints of this form that have conformal transformations that preserve the volume. That's how you should read this constraint. Okay. Now here's the kind of the global picture. Now normally when you have constraint systems, you have a phase space. And then what you want to do is you want to find a surface on that phase space where the constraints are satisfied. Okay? And so, but the problem is that these surfaces have gauge orbits. So what that means is that I didn't draw them on this surface here, s equals 0, the ones here. And that if you move along these directions, which I didn't draw, nothing physical would be changing. So this is just a fact that these momenta are not one-to-one maps. So you have a bunch of equivalence classes of states, of points in phase space, that if you move along these directions, you don't change the physical theory. And so what you need to do, generic always in a gauge theory, is pick a particular representative of those equivalence classes. And you call that a gauge fixing. Okay? So that's what this sort of line would be. This line would cut through all the foliations exactly once, and it would pick out a particular representative of those gauge orbits. And one convenient way to do that, to pick, this is called, you know, picking a section, or picking a gauge. And one convenient way to do that is to look for another surface in phase space which intersects this constraint surface exactly once. And it intersects it in the place where you're actually picking the section that you're picking the gauge. Okay? So this is a sort of standard picture from gauge theory, the Dirac and Adam theories. So that's what you do. You take a constraint surface and then you have to gauge fix it in order to quantize it. even to look at the classical equations of motion. Now, what we found is that there's something interesting that happened. If the gauge fixing surface, so this guy here, also is foliable, so it means it also has foliations that can be thought of as being generated by symmetries. Then what you can do is you can, and this has to be a proper gauge fixing, that's a non-trivial statement. Okay. 5 minutes left. Then that's with questions. Oh, okay. Then, what was I going to say? Then you can trade the symmetry, because you can think of this thing as the gauge, as the constraint surface, and this thing as the gauge fixing of that constraint surface. And that's sort of the basic picture that we have in mind when we're talking about the dual theory. Okay? So you basically just flip the picture around. You treat this as the thing. Okay. So that's where we're going. Now I'll just tell you the algorithm that we used to show that generalizability is actually dual to this. This thing. So this is the algorithm, and this is the most technical slide. So we start with these constraints, which we want to trade. Then what we do is we perform a canonical transformation generated by this generating functional. But what this thing does is it just sends, I didn't write it down. But it sends g to e to the 4 pi times g of t. And what happens is you basically introduce these two, this phi field and its country momentum. And these should be thought of as auxiliary fields. Because all we do is this canonical transformation. So we don't actually change any of the equations of motion, we don't modify the theory in any way. And this is the sort of thing that Hans was talking about, is you can artificially introduce a symmetry just by throwing in a variable in this way. Now, the reason why you know that this thing is the same theory is because you have these constraints generically that have come up. And basically, this piece is telling you that, it's telling you that you have an artificial symmetry, that if you, can formally transform the metric, but then compensate that by moving phi in the opposite direction, then you haven't changed anything. So this constraint is totally trivial. What it does is it restricts these degrees of freedom. Okay, so far we haven't done anything with the theory. But then what we do is we do something highly non-trivial, which is we impose this constraint here. We just impose it on the theory. Now, a principle that will modify the theory. Okay, and the reason why we're doing that, you can kind of see, is if this thing is zero, then this term drops out, and we're left with this constraint. And that's the constraint we want at the end of the day. But as I said, if you just impose a constraint on the theory, you're probably going to change it. It might not be consistent anymore, whatever. But what we can show is that this is, in fact, just a gauge fixing. So what you want is you want this constraint to be consistent with your transform scalar constraint. So you want the Poisson bracket between these two to be zero. Otherwise, the constraint will be propagated by the equations of motion. And it turns out that you can actually pick, this is a standard thing when you're dealing with second class constraints, that what you can do is you can pick a particular value of the Lagrange multiplier, which is always true. So what it means, and it turns out that this is a particular lattice function, which is called a sort of CMC lattice function. And so if you do generalize in this special gauge, the CMC gauge, then it turns out that instead of just modifying the theory by imposing this constraint, you're just fixing a particular gauge. All right. So that's the idea. And then you can do this trick where you define a Dirac bracket, and then these weak equalities turn into strong equalities, and you can just plug these back into your Hamiltonian. And the nice thing is that because this guy, this constraint's a phase space variable. When you plug these back into the Hamiltonian, the Dirac bracket reduces the Poisson bracket, and then we get our dual Hamiltonian. So that's basically what we did. And this is a trick that Dirac used in the 50s, which we just recycled here. Okay. So, head to the chase, because I don't have any time left, probably. 1 minute, yeah. Negative 1 minute. This is what we get. When we apply this procedure, we get a Hamiltonian that looks like this. Okay. It has these conformal constraints that we want. It has the diff constraint, which is the same thing here. And then it has this extra global piece. So we've traded all but one of the sort of S constraints for these guys, and we're left over with a global piece. Okay? And this global piece is the S that generates the rip parameterization invariance I talked about in the first slide. So this thing but it's very non-local. So you have to take the CMC lapse and integrate it over all the space, and that gives you this. And the CMC lapse is something that you get by solving a differential equation. So it's a very non-local thing. But this is our dual Hamiltonian. And the claim is that in the gauge n equals this times n, this is just a kind of global Lagrange multiplier. So if you pick a particular gauge where the lapse is just equal to this, and this lambda is equal to zero, then these two theories have identical equations of motion. So that's the bottom line. Okay. So just summary. I don't need to talk about all this.
I'm out of time, right?
Yeah. Okay. Then I just want to say maybe conceptual issues that might be interesting is what we've shown is that GR is dual to this theory, but what does that really mean? What does it mean physically? Because our theory itself is not Lorentz invariant. So the dual theory is just a bunch of spatial slices moving in time. But what you can't do is you can't use the lapse and the shift that you find to reconstruct a four-dimensional metric. But somehow, the physical content should be the same. So we need to understand what does a boost mean in this language? Is there some way, scale invariant way of thinking about a boost? But also, for quantum theory, you have this non-locality, so people are interested in doing hidden variables theories. Our theory is very non-local, and there's no worry about Lorentz invariance or causal structure. In fact, figuring out what the dual of causal structure is would also be a very interesting thing. It's still very early, this result's very new, so if people have any ideas about things that they want to work on or they want to talk about this in more detail, I'd be very happy to discuss it. Thank you. So that's the thing, is what we're hoping is that the structure has picked out an interesting feature of general relativity, which allows us to look at simple simple asymptotics or simple situations where this global Hamiltonian is tractable. And then you mentioned observables just very quickly. Okay, looking for quantities that commute with this global Hamiltonian will be very, very difficult. But then the question is, because it's just generating global time parameterizations, is that actually necessary? Or can we just throw those away? Because those are sort of like perennials. And it's not clear whether or not we need to look for observables or quantities of commute with this thing that generates parameterization. But that's a matter of things.
So is it possible to unparameterize from there? So you still have sort of a parameterization invariance with respect to this global time, right?
Yeah.
And that gives rise to a global constraint.
Yes.
So couldn't you unparameterize, try to find, for example, some nice privileged way of?
Yeah.
An example is sort of Jacobi's sort of time timeless mechanics, which has the square root action, right? And there. When you try to quantize it, it gives you all kinds of crap.
Yeah, I know.
But you can go back to Newtonian mechanics there, you can quantize and you get the spectacular success of the 20th century. So couldn't you do something similar here?
Absolutely. I mean, that's a possibility, right? Again, it's a matter of taste whether or not you want to do that. So a natural thing to pick would be the York time, because the York time is a very natural, I didn't really talk too much about it, but it's a natural thing in our framework. Another thing is maybe the proper time gauge or something, and that would be is maybe related to any modular gravity or something. So I think that just treating as the global thing, not as a constraint, but as a Hamiltonian, is really the direction that we're trying to go. Think of it as really generating time evolution, because otherwise it's very difficult to deal with, as you know. But again, it's a matter of taste. Some people would not be very happy if I suggest, and have been when I've given up talks on this before, to suggest that. So not everyone is happy to be that. But yeah. No, good question, thank you. Yeah.
So if you wanted to quantize general relativity, does this result about its formulation as a scale invariant theory tell you that you're going to have problems? Well, that there ought to be no fundamental length scale. So I guess I'm asking, what's your kind of response to the problem that Hans talked about? How would you eliminate fundamental length scales, if I'm correct?
Well, okay, so we still have, okay, so one thing that's important is we still have a global, so first of all, we're doing this only for, well, the thing that I presented was only for compact manifolds, so we have a volume. The thing has a volume. And so there is a fundamental length scale, which is the volume of the universe. But that's just a global length scale. So this is the local one that we've gotten rid of. And so to get rid of the global one, there's some tricks that maybe like the stuff that Hans is doing can help with. But right now, as we speak, there's still a kind of global scale, so that's not really a worry. But what's nice is actually the opposite. If you try to quantize this theory, there might be the symmetry. I mean, symmetry is very important in sort of quantum theory, at least field theory, like if you think about field theory, because it's the symmetry that tells you what your theory space is. And then basically, renormalization group flow just takes you, moves you around in that theory space. So we know what the theory space is of this dual theory. It's conformal superspace, the space, all theories invariant under conformal diffeomorphisms. And that's a really nice symmetry. It's the symmetry that the Hajava-Lipschitz gravity has at high energy. And there's all these power counting arguments that protect the theory. And so it might be that this symmetry reveals something, I mean, it might be that this symmetry is telling us something good about the renormalizability of GR. Basically, because if there's no length scale, then there's no worry about divergences at small energy. I don't know if that answers your question. We're hoping that this will make the quantum theory easier. The other thing is we know the physical Hilbert space of the theory if we throw away this global thing, and then we know the physical Hilbert space. And that's something that no one's been able to do before.